Okay, so I'm Lance Tenenbaum. It's November 10th at 8:14 in the morning. I'm here with, would you mind introducing yourself, sir?
I'm Jacob Richard Hershey II. I go by Rick, that's my nickname.
Great. And we're here to do Professor Berkner's final assignment, the Vietnam-era veteran oral historian session. Okay. So just a little getting started. If there's any introduction you want to do, if there's anything you briefly want to know about me, you're welcome to know.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
You're doing your thing. Good.
Great. So let's start. What are your earliest memories? What's the
Well, I was born in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Okay, great.
I don't remember when I was born. It was February 25th, 1946 at the Annie Warner Hospital. The reason I was born here is because my father had been he was a graduate in Gettysburg, class of 32.
Okay.
And he had come back from World War II, even in the Pacific. In fact, he was going to be on the invasion forces into Japan.
Oh, wow.
And Operation Olympic, mm-hmm. If you look through your history there.
Was that the invasion of Kyushu?
Kyushu, that's yeah. Exactly right.
Right.
And so I was in my mother's belly, whatever, she was pregnant with me. My dad was going to go fight the Japanese, and then they dropped the bombs, and that was it. And he did go into Japan. Mm-hmm. We have pictures of that into the occupation.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I probably should bring it over here sometime and give it to you guys. A whole scrapbook of his pictures he shot.
That'd be awesome. I'm sure Special Collections would love that.
Anyway, that was so I was born here, and we went out, and he got his job back at the. National Park here. He was chief engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived at the Weikert House on the battlefield. If you go up the battlefield, there's a Weikert House out mm-hmm. there. We lived there as an infant. Mm-hmm. And then he got recalled to active duty as a lieutenant colonel in the Corps of Engineers.
And do you know approximately what year that was?
That was about 1946.
Okay.
About 1946. Mm-hmm. And eventually we made ourselves out to Spokane, Washington. I don't know why we went to Spokane, Washington, but eventually we went up to Alaska.
Oh, wow.
My dad he took a battalion of engineers, about 500-600 people, up to Ladd Field, which is at Fairbanks. And I went, and my mom and I went with him. I was an infant, and he built a railroad spur from it. Which is still with the railroad is still there today, from Fairbanks down to what became Eielson Air Force Base, one of the SAC bases that we were building in the late 40s because of the Russians and everything. So Eielson Air Force Base is built because my father built a rail line down there. And that was 2 years. I lived in Alaska the first time, 1947 to 49.
So you only stayed there as long as his deployment lasted, and then you guys got out of there.
It really wasn't a deployment. He was in the United States.
Right.
It was a territory at the time, and so I was there with my father and my mother, and took us back to the States. Went back to the States. Then he went to teach ROTC at Auburn University.
Mm-hmm.
I attended the kindergarten at Auburn. I remember learning to play a violin at age 4, something like that. I think that was maybe the Suzuki method. Anyway, I remember my sister being born. She was born in Auburn University. She now lives in South Carolina.
Okay.
Sister Lindy, Harry mm-hmm. Melinda Hershey. And from there, we went there for a while. Then we went to Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And then he got called to the Korean War.
Oh, okay.
So we came back to Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. He bought a house, which became the West Cottage. It used to be right over there, mm-hmm. across from what we called the Sub. It's been torn down now. And we owned the West Cottage for several years.
Not to cut off your story, but sure. I was just wondering if you could describe your mother a little bit. We haven't really heard about
mother,
her.
Mother, okay. Dorothy Troxell Hershey. A real feisty lady, never went to college, but she could have gone to college. Married my dad in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
they couldn't have, they she had several miscarriages, and then I came along, and my, as my sister said, I was called the Crown Prince. And Mom lived here in Gettysburg, and Mom lived in, she died in 2007, she passed away. Mm-hmm. Lived out at Woodcrest, 80 Woodcrest Drive was the house that we had there for years and years and years. Bought that in 1962. Anyway, my mom, very feisty lady. I get my singing ability from him. What was that?
Driving to Spokane.
Oh, yeah. My mother, this is the other thing that happened. Okay. So my father was in Korea. He gets reassigned to go to Okinawa. Mm-hmm. This is about early 1954. Right. My mother sold the house here, got my sister, she drove to Spokane, Washington, too, and had four flat tires by herself, no interstates or anything like that. Mm-hmm. She did the same thing going across country. I don't know if we took a train or whatever to San Francisco. We get into San Francisco in the Embarcadero area, which is all built up. It's a fancy place. They have restaurants there now. Have you ever been to San Francisco?
I have been.
It's the Embarcadero area, mm-hmm. and that's where we got on the USS Mitchell, which is a troop ship.
Right.
And it was not a cruise ship. It was a troop ship. And the three of us went across the Pacific for 17 days.
Oh, so you went to Okinawa with your father?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I went to Okinawa and my sister.
Right.
And remember, I'm aboard the ship just outside of San Francisco. The waves were like this. And so the stateroom went up and down and up. And my sister and I would run down the run down. And then we go up again. My mother was getting sick while we were doing this thing. I still remember that. That was 1954. Went to Okinawa. My father met us there. Mm-hmm. We lived in the Zukaran area. The school I went to is still there. You can Google elementary schools in Okinawa. And that same place is there. I still remember it.
Wow.
I was in fourth grade by that time. I was a third grade here in Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. I was a fourth grade there. And we were there for about 15, 16 months. Then we went, right. We came back, the whole family now, my father and I, and my mother and my sister, we came back across the Pacific, didn't have planes to do it back then.
Yeah.
On the troop ship back to San Francisco. He bought a car and we drove cross country. Remember, through the Mojave Desert, we had a little desert water, no AC, by the way, no radio, no AC. Oh my God. And we went across country to back to the Gettysburg area to see family, but then back to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, which was in San Antonio, and he was the post engineer there.
Right.
In charge of the facilities there on the particular place there. So we were there 2 years. I was there in the fourth. I went took the fourth grade again. My mother wanted me to be back in the same age group, in the fifth grade there at Fort Sam Houston, and we moved from there. We moved to Long Island,
right.
New York.
Yep.
And that was quite interesting. I was in the sixth grade there. I was in the West End Elementary School. Mm-hmm. Still remember it. And I spoke like a normal person while the local folks spoke like they were from Long Island or New York or whatever. So they called me Tex. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't have a Texas accent, but I had been from Texas, and I was there from the sixth grade. And I remember seeing the Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts on TV.
Right.
Remember having Jewish friends. First time I ever had, didn't know what these Jewish folks were. I know Jesus was a Jew and all that, but didn't know anything about that. But we had a bunch of Jewish friends there because a bunch of people of that heritage were in the... I said, are you Jewish?
I am, yes.
I forget that name there, too.
Yeah, it's a giveaway.
We've been to Israel twice, by the way.
Oh, wow. Well, we can talk about that later. I'm happy to talk about that.
That's cool. Anyway, so we were there sixth grade. Then my father was involved in the Corps of Engineers. So he actually worked on Church Street in downtown Manhattan, mm-hmm. actually, which is the building he worked in was right next to the hole from 9/11. Okay. I mean, right next to it, because he told me about that. He was up in Greenland and up in Canada building bases, either SAC bases or radar sites.
Right.
Because of the Cold War.
Just pause for a second. Sorry.
Sure.
I just wanted to know, what sort of influence did your father being in the military have on you as a little kid? What did you think of your father's job? What did you really know?
I didn't know much about it. He wasn't in a troop unit. He was never in a troop unit as that I knew him. He was a commander of an engineer battalion
right.
in Alaska, and I was that kid. And then he was in Korea. I think he was involved in he had a unit there.
Mm-hmm.
But I never was involved in that. I knew I figured military might be a good place for me to go when I grow up and everything.
But, just because your dad was?
Because my dad was in the service.
Okay.
I saw what he was doing too. So nobody, I didn't know anybody else involved in that too.
Okay.
Now we moved to Buffalo, New York. I was in the 7th grade there.
Oh wow, more moving.
We moved to Buffalo, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the same thing, actually Kenmore, New York. We're actually right across from Kenmore Elementary School. There in the 7th grade. Don't have too many memories about that, but it was cold up in Buffalo. Was cold, and from then he got reassigned to Alaska
again,
Fort Greely, Alaska, which was 100 miles south of Fairbanks. It was a test and evaluation of a place for the Army, and also cold weather mountain school. So I went there. I was there in the 8th and 9th grade. I had a ball. I was a Boy Scout, involved in the woods and everything. You walk out the door, you're in the middle of the wilderness there too. And we have bears on post, and we have buffalo all over the place too.
Absolutely. And was that something out being in the outdoors, being a Boy Scout? Did you do that before as a child?
Yeah,
or
I was.
Just,
yeah,
start?
Long Island, I was a scout,
right,
and then I was up in Buffalo, yeah, I'm a scout there too. So
okay,
so two years in Alaska, he goes back to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is just south of Washington D.C.,
mm-hmm.
where we lived off post and we moved on post. And we had these nice quarters. That's what they call them in places where you live when you're assigned to,
right.
on post.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually 5 doors down from some place he lived when he was a first lieutenant. This time he was still a lieutenant colonel. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. He taught at the engineer school there, and then we went to Gettysburg, bought a house in Gettysburg, and I finished high school. I went to 4 different high schools.
Mm-hmm. So you were still moving around.
Yeah, still moving around.
Yeah.
So I ended up in Gettysburg, finished high school here,
mm-hmm.
Junior and senior year. And then I said, what am I going to do? Well, I think I wanted to be in the Army. So, I knew I could get in here. I was a legacy,
mm-hmm.
get in as a legacy. So I got in as a legacy, as a biology major, chemistry minor.
And
what's that?
Thought you wanted to go to West Point.
Yeah, I did want to go to West Point, but I didn't get selected. My grades weren't high enough.
Right.
But they were good enough for Gettysburg, which was, I guess it was okay. I don't know what that means. Didn't cost as much back then as you guys are paying right now.
You're definitely right about that.
And eventually I joined Sigma Nu fraternity. It was a Sigma.
Oh, okay. So you were a Sigma Nu brother.
I was a Sigma Nu brother.
Right.
In fact, if you go over to the library and look at the exhibits of the guys who were killed in Vietnam. That's one reason I'm not here. One of my brothers was Andy Marsh,
mm-hmm.
and there's a picture of our fraternity there, and you'll see me right in the middle of it too. I was the pledge marshal at the time.
Oh wow!
This guy tortured the pledges, whatever. and anyway, we were here. Met Judy. Probably knew of her my sophomore year.
Oh, so you went to Gettysburg College as
yes.
well?
Oh,
that's how you guys met. Okay.
Yeah, she
okay.
met here on campus. And then we started dating. I got dumped by her best friend. And she's actually, and her name is Marsha Walker Boot. And she's like, still good. We we saw back in the 50th anniversary here. We're so good friends, sent Christmas cards and everything. Mm-hmm. And we got graduated on the 2nd of June.
I don't want to rush things a little.
Sure, no. Let's go back.
It's fine.
I'm hopping around too much.
No. You're doing great. I just have a couple questions about your college time and perhaps the end of your high school.
Yeah.
So you said you were a biology and biology major, chemistry minor. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason you chose those? Was it because...
I was stupid.
Oh, so you just picked something.
Somebody should have slapped the crap out of me. What are you doing, fool?
Why?
Because you should have been a history major.
I should have been a history major, maybe economics or stuff like that, because that's why I get my... Eventually, I had a master's degree and MBA, but...
In history?
No.
Oh, in biology.
No, I eventually got an MBA from the College of St. Thomas, now University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, with specialization in contract management.
Okay, so that's
business. A whole different story right there.
Right.
We'll go back to that.
Yes. Okay, so... how big, while you were on campus, how big of a part of your life was Sigma Nu? Was the fraternity life like on campus
back
then?
Huge, big.
And what year was that you joined Sigma Nu?
64.
Okay.
Graduated 68.
So you would describe the influence of the fraternity as large on the campus. Could you go into that a little bit? Like, what was it like for the average frat brother?
I lived at home for my first 2 years. Then I moved on the campus. I washed dishes for my board. And my parents helped cover my room.
Mm-hmm. So you financed yourself while you were.
I financed myself. I got a loan which totaled. When I graduated, I owed $3,000 of my loan.
That's not too bad.
That's about a month right now.
That he didn't tell me about.
I didn't tell her about that, too. I had a negative net worth at the time.
Okay.
She had a positive net worth.
Like most college students today.
Like most college students.
And where did your siblings end up going to school?
My sister. My sister went to Cahaba College down in North Carolina. And she met her husband there, too.
And what was your relationship like? Was it hard to be away from your sister?
No.
No, you guys were good at that.
We were good at that, yeah.
Okay. Okay, is there anything else about your time at Gettysburg that you want to talk about? Is there anything
love
that sticks
the fraternity.
Out?
We did a lot of dumb things, made movies. We made, instead of studying, we made 8mm movies. We made one of a Bonnie and Clyde knockoff that we shot out at Caledonia around in the back. The dumbest thing we did, you'd love this one. The dumbest thing we did, we made a World War II kind of Hogan's Heroes, German Nazi thing, it was called Ambush. So it starts out in the back of the house. This is 44 West Broadway. This is the old fraternity house, not the one they have right now.
Okay.
And one of her brothers, Dave Shutter, he's still around. He's still in the Pittsburgh area. I didn't see him. He made a giant Nazi flag with a swastika in it. He hung it down from the balcony, and he pretended to be Hitler.
Right.
While we were the acolytes, or just cheering and everything. Unbeknownst to us, one of our neighbors was a survivor of the Holocaust.
Oh, my God.
We didn't have to go see the dean of students the next day. Our president did.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sure that was a fun interview.
It was kind of a poor taste thing, but we didn't know that. No, we wouldn't have done it if we knew it, but shit.
So you guys were just normal college kids.
We were normal college kids. We did. Normal college kids had good times. Usually at Sunday, we'd have our dates go over to the house and have dinner in the basement. That's sure. Where it was. And,
were classes difficult for you guys? Were they? Would you describe them as hard or easy? Or
it was hard.
It was hard.
It was hard.
Yeah.
One interesting thing, can I throw this in?
That? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so we became in 64. There was a difference in the requirements for men and women.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Women had to have a much higher high school grade point average and had to be in the top 10% of their class.
Right.
I don't know about the men.
Yeah, gosh,
so the ratio was two men to every
year.
woman at the time.
That's
so
right.
The admission requirements were totally different.
They're totally different.
Which I don't think they could do today.
No, definitely not.
For the guys, now, they had a little thing called the draft.
Yeah, yeah. So you registered for the draft, or you
joined ROTC? Well, no, we were 2S. We had a deferment because we were going to college.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, I went to ROTC here.
Yes.
So I knew I was going to go in the military, and I'd probably go wherever it had to go. Vietnam really hadn't started up until about 65.
Sorry. I don't mean to interrupt.
But no, go ahead.
So when you joined the ROTC, you weren't aware there was going to be a war. You were just joining because you thought it was a good career opportunity for you, because your father
was
in the Army.
That was the reason. And then it kind of started to happen, and
Okay. So, sorry. Yeah. Please continue. I don't mean to interrupt you.
And so, let's see. We would drill right in front of the plant gymnasium. It started there, and then they built a facility across the railroad tracks at that. Near the little pond they have over there. There's a building next to it. Mm-hmm. That was the ROTC facility, and that's where we drilled and went to classes over there too.
Okay.
Went classes twice a week there too. Mm-hmm. And then between our junior and senior year, we had a summer camp at Indian Town Gap Military Reservation up in Pennsylvania, just outside of, I think, Harrisburg or something. That's up there.
Were there a lot of guys in ROTC at that point?
A number of them.
A number, okay.
Not a lot.
So most people weren't interested in the military. They were just there.
Not really.
Okay.
They didn't get interested in the military until they started drafting college students. How about that? Oh, we can't have a war now because us precious college students, they might get hurt. Well, the hell with the high schools, this riffraff, the trash at the high schools. So there was a little bit of, I don't know, cultural thing there.
Maybe like a class element.
Element there. Sure. Yeah, the lower classes get to go and die for their country, while the upper classes, we're too much more valuable. Our families are too much more important. They have more money than the riffraff down here on the other side of the city.
So that affected you when you were approximately?
A little bit. I remember when LBJ made those announcements, there was an announcement made on television in the fraternity. And all the guys who weren't in ROTC kind of got nervous then, too.
Because they realized they might be up to the plate at that point.
That's right. Still remember that.
Okay.
That one.
So let's talk about...
Anyway, so we graduated on the 2nd of June. And then I see something didn't happen on the 2nd of June. Yeah. See, something supposed to have happened. On the 2nd of June... Before the actual graduation, we had the commencement ceremony. they had all the ROTC folks get their rank pinned on, because we're made second lieutenants. And Judy pinned one on one shoulder, and my mother printed one on the other shoulder. Mm-hmm. And then we had graduation. Then the French ambassador speak. What a wasted piece of crap that guy was.
Couldn't understand him.
Couldn't understand a bit.
So that was the only reason you say that you couldn't understand him?
I could understand. He was speaking in English, French. But it was a nothing there too. But now fast forward. I'm going through about 10 years after this, I've gone through this box and I come upon a beer mug. Say, honey, what's the beer mug for? Oh, that's what I was going to give you on graduation as a graduation gift. Well, why didn't you give it to me? Well, because I didn't get my graduation gift. She didn't get her ring. She got her ring about a month later.
Right.
Everybody got engaged. Everybody. Anybody that was serious.
But I wasn't smart enough to figure that out. So
that was standard practice at the time. Was at the end of college.
Yeah, pretty much.
If you were with somebody, generally. Okay.
Oh, by the way, the fraternity, after we got pinned and everything, they go serenade the couples.
Right.
I don't know if they still do that. They sing, there's a song, called Sigma New Girl, and they serenaded that. That was kind of neat, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's neat, yeah.
I'll have to ask my friends who are Sigma New Brothers.
Ask them if they've done the serenades. I'm Zeta, you can tell them I'm Zeta Sigma 194. That's my number.
Okay, I'll have to talk.
You talked off the Zeta Sigma 194. Anyway, okay. Anyway, so on the fifth of July 1968, I go down and propose, and I got engaged. Mm-hmm. And then on the 20th of July, I'm off to the Army.
Oh, wow.
Off to
that soon.
Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Drove out there and spent the next 12 weeks learning to be a field artillery officer. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Judy's planning the wedding. I graduate in October. We get married on the 26th of October, 68. Mm-hmm. And then we're off to our next adventure. Eventually, we end up after our honeymoon in Gatlinburg, where they didn't have any food because it was the end of the season. And before Gatlinburg isn't the way it is today, but there wasn't much out there. And we end up Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And we were there. I'm in the Army training unit. I'm a second lieutenant helping train soldiers to become civilians, become soldiers as a basic training unit. They had me there to get me in a troop unit before I go to Vietnam.
So at this point, you knew you were going to go to Vietnam.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Well, if you were in the military, if you were an officer, you're going to Vietnam.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Highly probable. So from there, we then go back to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for the Vietnam orientation course, which is a 6 week course, and we lived in a trailer out near the airport. And Judy opened the door of the trailer one day, and what popped?
There's a horse standing. I grew up in the suburbs, so having a horse at my front door was
a bit of a surprise.
She's a city girl over here, too, so the city girl did that, too. Anyway, so then we go back to Silver Spring, Maryland, and Judy gets an apartment there. And then you had a job with the Postal Service, right?
Right.
Yeah, actually a good job with your GS-7 or something
seven,
like that.
Yeah.
GS-7 with the Postal Service. And I'm off to Vietnam. I arrived in Vietnam. I ended up with the 2nd Battalion, 32nd Field Artillery. Actually, Charlie Battery. You can see my little thing here. Mm-hmm. This is what I've been to several reunions from the unit I've been in.
But at the time, you didn't know this would be obviously.
I didn't know
this would be part of your life.
Anything like that, and
yeah.
So one of the things I did, I shot a lot of pictures, and if you'd like to get my pictures, I'll send them to you.
Absolutely.
I have them on Shutterfly. Write down. Can you write down your email address?
We can do that after if you'd like.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah.
In fact, I sent the pictures on Shutterfly to your professor.
Oh, but I'm sure he loves that. I'm sure
he loves that. There's 722 of them, and I put a comment on each one of them.
And
Judy's in a couple of them too.
And just out of curiosity, what made you take those pictures?
I was a photographer. I had my own.
Okay.
I had my own darkroom in the basement. I shot slides. Full-frame slides and half-frame slides. And I didn't do anything with them for years. And then I said, if I don't do anything to myself, they're going to be gone. Mm-hmm. So I scanned them. Now, you can have somebody scan your slides now or pictures. Because now don't do that. It's all digital.
Right.
But like when I went the first time I went to Israel, I took 4,000 shots. It's pretty hard to scan 4,000.
It's a lot.
Anyway, it's a lot.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was kind of neat. So, go to Vietnam. I was at different fire bases. I was in an 8-inch 175 heavy artillery battery.
There were
four guns.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. There are certain things that I need to, that Professor Berkner would be remiss if I didn't include
right,
in this.
Sure.
When you first arrived to Vietnam, do you know the military base that you arrived at? Do you know?
Yeah, I arrived in Cam Ranh Bay.
Cam Ranh Bay.
And that's where everybody flew into. From there, I was sent down to Tan Son Nhut Air Force at Tonsa Air Base, and then I went to the 90th replacement organization. They replaced guys coming in, guys going out, so they had to find what I did and put me in a place, and I didn't have any idea where I was, what I was going to be doing as an artillery officer or...
And were you nervous at that point? Were you...
No.
No, were you excited? What were you feeling?
It's part of the thing. Actually, I was, when I was going over there, they were landing on the moon.
So was that the big... The
blast off?
Right.
We were in her sister's basement watching the moon rocket go off.
The last night.
The very next day I went to Vietnam.
Okay.
Yeah. That was on the 20th of July. Yeah. 1969.
Talk about not being in a unit.
Yeah, I wasn't in a unit because I was in the replacement process. Eventually, I ended up with the 2nd Battalion 32nd Field Artillery.
Right. And so, what were your main objectives when you were in Vietnam with that unit?
Survive.
That was everybody's objective, I imagine.
Yeah, that was number one.
Yeah.
Get to go home.
And while you were there, were there any friends you made that stick out to you that you want to talk about?
Not really.
No?
No.
How would you describe your time in the Army when you were in Vietnam?
It was busy. I was in... I started in base camps, but I was then on a bunch of fire support bases. And when I look back, I'm saying, oh, my God, how dangerous that was. I didn't realize at the time how dangerous it was. We could have been overrun at any time, some of the places I was at.
And there's nothing that sticks out to you that you remember thinking, wow, this is very dangerous?
Most of the time,
I guess you're usually handling, live ammunition and explosives. And...
Well, I was the executive officer. I was the guy who essentially got the guns to be aimed at the right place.
So you learned how to use a radio. Were you a radio operator, or you had someone to do that for you?
I had somebody do that for us.
Right. So you were just directing the fire that you were, and you were.
I wasn't directing the fire. That would be a field. That would be a forward observer. I was the guy kind of running the whole thing. I was running the firing battery. There was other things going on. There was a fire direction center, and we had a big old computer. We had handheld like slide rules to calculate everything and. That's all done on something like you have right there in front of you now, too.
So you weren't, in the thick of it, up in the front, lines, you were...
There were no front lines, but I was in the front lines. We had artillery coming in at us, rockets coming in.
Hand to hand.
I wasn't in the bush, say. I didn't go out on patrols. I stayed in fire bases.
So that was your job, was to be there.
That was my job to be there. And then go back and forth on roads, which is kind of dangerous, too.
And just out of curiosity, I don't know how relevant of a question this will be. Why didn't you, did you consider joining the engineers like your father?
No.
It wasn't something you were interested in?
No.
Okay.
Didn't want to do it. I would be in the combat arms, I think. And field artillery was what I chose.
So you chose that specifically? Yeah. Any reason you chose that?
No. I didn't want to be infantry.
Okay, fair enough. So approximately how long were you in your artillery regiment?
I was in an artillery battalion.
Battalion, sorry.
In my battery, which is about 150 people in it. We were in it for a year. I was in Vietnam for a year.
So in total, you were only in Vietnam. Or not only, you were in Vietnam.
Most people were in Vietnam, tour duties 1 year, 365 days.
Okay, that makes sense.
And one of the things that guys would do is they'd fill out a calendar. They'd make a calendar with 365 little slots on it. And they'd fill in each one.
And did you have a calendar like that?
No, I didn't. Other people did. Because you got real nervous when you got under 100 days, you became a two-digit midget. And you heard all these stories about guys who bought it or bought the farm.
So they were counting
with a couple of days to go.
Yeah.
Like I was at this one place, Far Sport Base, Devon, and a guy was going out to a place to Claymore Mines. It's a directional mine with shoots all these ball bearings out at you to stop a human wave attack. And he didn't ground himself properly, and the thing went off above him. below it. He was messing with it when I took him out, killed him immediately. He had 8 days to go.
Wow.
And you heard stories like that. You said, you know, turn these last couple of days, you know, I made it this far. Let's just be careful about this whole thing, too.
And during this whole time, what was communication with your wife and communication back home like?
Good question. Back then, we had free letters. We could mail anything out free. And we used 3.5-inch tape players.
Oh, so you recorded messages?
We recorded messages. Now, the problem is, you want to tell them the problem?
We did a really dumb thing. We recorded over. Oh. He would send me a tape, and I would record over it.
It's a shame. So, there's no way you guys could have.
I mean, you just.
I have a picture.
When you're that age, you don't think about it.
I have a picture of me.
Years, I'd love to.
I have a picture of me recording. I have somebody to take a picture of me, meaning the microphone, recording one of my things up too.
So that was how you guys communicated rather than writing letters or anything?
Oh, we wrote letters too.
We wrote a few, not
a few letters, but mostly that. Right. Most of that, Judy sent me a Christmas tree, backed up a Christmas tree. It got lost somehow. Sent me a bottle of sparkling wine, but it wasn't alcohol wine, for our first anniversary. I have a picture of that and a big old candle for that. And that. Oh, some of those pictures are in the in my photos I've done.
There wasn't a lot of communication. I mean, obviously there's no Skype.
Right. Can't Skype, no internet, no nothing. I've got like guys over in Afghanistan. They can be on Skype and whatever, talking to families at home.
Yeah,
could do that. They had something called Mars, which was I think we attempted it once. It didn't really work out. Using a shortwave. So you have to say, I love you, over. How are things going, over? And then the other person had to say over too, between the radio communications and everything too.
And just another quick aside. How did your parents feel about you serving? Were they, or your father, your mother, were they?
Fine.
Your mother wasn't worried. I mean, was she worried? No.
Probably was. What do you think, Tom?
No more than. I don't think it was like today where you know, first of all, the deployments weren't over and over and over again.
It was just the one, right?
Maybe
General,
two. Maybe two.
Oh, okay.
If you're in.
I don't think she was worried.
Yeah.
Too much.
I guess she was used to it with your father having been in the service already.
Yeah, a little bit. They had an idea what to expect, and that's part of my duty. That's what I've been there for.
It's hard to tell about his father because he was very quiet.
My dad's quiet. Extremely quiet.
So you didn't hear a lot about his thoughts on the matter?
Nope.
Okay.
He kept a lot of stuff to himself.
So moving on towards the end of the war,
and
you talked about other people with, you know, as the days were winding down, trying to keep safe and, you know, make it home and the calendars and.
Yeah. That's normal for anybody.
So emotionally for you, how was that process? As the days were getting closer, what was your thought process like?
Yeah,
it was just get home.
Just get home and do our thing and. And take care of the guys who are still there, too, mm-hmm. because you had friends there. You have guys there for a short period of time. And along that whole thing, as one of the things you were able to do is go on a rest and recuperation trip, which is called R&R. If you're married, you could go to Hawaii. You couldn't go back to the States. You could go to Hawaii. And so I flew out to Hawaii about 9 months in. I flew out to Hawaii. And
9 months into your tour.
9 months into the tour. You said 6 months, but it was 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
It was February of 70. It was February of 70, I think, about that time. We went to Hawaii, and then Judy met me out there, and we had our second honeymoon out there, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed at a cabin at Bellows Air Force Station. While I was there, there was a big attack in our area.
Oh.
In fact, you should write this down. Check out Far Support Base Illinsworth. There's been books written on it too and everything else. We had about 23 guys killed. Because one of the things we learned later that the military was doing, they put these far support bases out there as a lure for the North Vietnamese to attack.
To try to provoke them to come out.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd slaughter them, but they kill a bunch of us too.
Yeah. And so this was while you were in Hawaii, found out.
Yeah, that happened. I had attacks. To another part of my battalion, It didn't hit us. We had some rockets come into our where our battery was, but.
So you guys were mostly in the clear from that. You weren't in the firing bases for the most.
Or we were. We were there. Yeah. They just attacked us. Right. They didn't attack ours.
Would you say that a lot of the war was just getting lucky? It was just being in the right place.
Yeah,
and
part of it.
Yeah.
It's just that part of life too. You know.
I would say so.
Going. Who said about forks in the road? Yogi Berra said, if you come to a fork in the road, he said, take it. But you got to make those decisions in life. Like, you'll be making decisions when you graduate. What am I going to do with the rest of my life kind of thing?
Yeah.
Am I going to get a mate or something like that? And I chose well. She chose well, too, I guess. Anyway. I know I chose well.
And so I guess you would say that your time in Hawaii was the best part of your deployment.
Yeah, that was okay. Yeah, probably was. It was fun. Yeah, we had pictures of it. We had pictures in my pictures and everything too.
Car broke down 3 times.
Car broke down 3 times. Had a Datsun.
A Datsun. I'm sure my grandpa would know. He's a big car.
That's a Nissan.
Oh, okay.
That's what they used to call Nissans. Datsuns. I don't know why that. I don't know. Maybe the knee. I don't know. It's a Datsun. And the damn thing broke down.
Just for the sake of the interview, if Hawaii was considered one of the better points of your deployment, would you be able to describe one of the worst points of your deployment? Is there anything that sticks out to you?
Yeah, maybe Fire Support Base Fort Defiance. We got attached. We split the battery up and I got 2 8-inch howitzers. Self-propelled howitzers, and I was attached to the 11th Armored Cav Regiment. Mm-hmm. And we went up into the really jungle. I mean, going through triple canopy jungle, monkeys with teeth this long, bamboo vipers all over the place, nasty stuff.
Traps and stuff, and anything like that?
And they were going cross country. They were just making their own tracks and everything, too. Mm-hmm. And eventually the place where we were at was attacked, but not after we had left there by that time there too. But it was nasty. It was Fire Support Base Fort Defiance.
Did you ever see a Vietnamese soldier at any point, whether alive or dead?
Dead ones.
Yeah. I guess that was a common theme at the time.
Yeah, If the Vietnamese would catch a Viet Cong and they kill them, they'd leave them in the street for a while.
If the Vietnamese would catch a Viet Cong, what do you mean by that?
After they killed them, they'd leave the body in the street for a while.
I'm sorry, I don't fully understand.
They leave the body.
No, I understand.
They shoot you. Who's and put you in the street.
Vietnamese versus Viet Cong, I think that's...
The Vietnamese... Okay, the South Vietnamese.
Oh, the South Vietnamese. Okay.
If they catch the enemies, if they shot the guy, they'd leave the body out in the middle of the street as a kind of as a warning to others.
Did you have a lot of interaction with the South Vietnamese? Were they there?
No. I did. Other people did. In my case, I didn't. Nice people, I guess. It's like everybody else.
Sure.
I'm going to ask talk about life in the battery. Fire support base.
Well, we got up in the morning and we'd have usually a hot breakfast maybe and then lunchtime would be sea rations. Mm-hmm. We might have something at dinner. It was very boring. We usually fired all night. We fire H&I fires. Firing means shooting the guns.
Mm-hmm.
H&I harassment interdiction fire. So somebody at higher headquarters would plot places out in the jungle that we'd shoot out there thinking the bad guys might be there. We didn't know that. Sometimes we'd have hot fire missions where we were firing in support of an attack or something like that too. But we were very busy. We were very busy every day. And then if you fired this ammunition, you had to bring it in. You had to hump it out. Projectiles weighed... The 8-inch weighed 200 pounds apiece. The 175 weighed about 147 pounds, and then you'd have the propellant, which is in sealed canisters about that high. So you had to move all the stuff out. It was just a lot of just hard work.
So part of your job wasn't, you weren't just firing the guns or directing fire. You were actually
then the logistics and moving the stuff around too.
That was all your job.
And then we'd have to move the logistics in. We'd have to provide our own safety in areas. We'd have guys out in guard duty and everything else. We had to check on the guards, make sure the guards weren't asleep. People do that. Mm-hmm. They go to sleep.
Okay.
I do.
We're talking a lot about Vietnam. There's is there anything? Are we missing anything? I don't want to leave anything.
I don't think so. What do you think, Ellie?
As far as your time in, because I'm only supposed to interview up until around 1975 or whatever time you left Vietnam.
We're in 1970 right now.
Well, I'm approximately whatever time you left Vietnam is when I'm supposed to.
Oh, okay.
We could talk more, but that, you know.
Well, that's when I left Vietnam, was 19. And
I just want to make sure you get in everything that you think should be on the recording. If there's anything that you feel like you haven't, you know, discussed. Here's a question. How did your sister feel about your service? Was she just the same as your parents? Was
probably. It,
so it, this wasn't a spoken thing. You didn't talk to your sister about being deployed?
No. She thought I was back.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, I showed all my pictures to everybody. Of course, everybody's very, very nice. And let me show them all my slides on one
700 slides.
No, there was more than that, I think.
Well,
I didn't find, I only found 700 and some of them.
And as far as your photography hobby, when would you say you got interested in that? How long?
1960.
Okay.
I got my first 35. It was a Kodak Pony 4 camera. I think I still might even have it somewhere.
And you bought that yourself, or was that given?
I got it as a present for Christmas in Alaska.
And so, when you were in Vietnam, what was Christmas like in Vietnam? There's something I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. See, Christmas. Oh yeah, one of our fire bases. We were at Fire Support Base Elaine, which is outside Cu Chi. It was Thanksgiving. We had Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and turkeys and everything. Military makes a big deal of it. And then about that time, we had some guys come in from a USO tour. And it was Jim Mudcat Grant, baseball player, mm-hmm. Louis Kuhn, the head of the baseball at the time, and a guy named Joe DiMaggio. You probably heard of Joe DiMaggio,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And he was going there and talking to the troops and everything, and so we got our pictures taken with the guys. That was kind of neat. Christmas, I see. I was at Fort Farnsworth Base Devon at Christmas, and there's a picture of me eating. I don't have my shirt on, have my hat on. I have a can of beer in one hand. I'm eating a turkey leg on the other.
So Christmas was good in Vietnam.
It was okay. It was just another day.
Yeah.
Another day. Vietnam was seven days a week, 365 days a year. You didn't get off for the weekends. You didn't get to go home.
Yeah, of course.
Or go anything. It was 24/7.
And as far as your comrades and the soldiers that you had around you, just maybe a little history for the record. Did you see a lot of African-American troops while you were deployed?
Yeah, we had a couple of guys in the unit.
And
no officers, but we had some. We had a couple of NCOs, non-commissioned officers, were African-American. We had a couple of guys, yeah. In fact, you'll see with some of the pictures I shot.
And forgive my lack of knowledge. I don't know. Were you guys integrated at that point?
Yeah.
That was in the 50s? The
guys who integrated us was Harry Truman in the early 40s. In fact, we went to a movie last night. We went to see Overlord yesterday.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that one yet.
And I'm a big movie guy.
Yeah.
And they have a black guy in the unit. And this is 1944. That was not the case. They had not integrated the forces. The African Americans were using logistics functions, driving trucks, stuff like that.
Was there anyone you knew who had a problem with the African American troops? No, that wasn't a thing that you saw.
Yeah, when you're in the foxhole, all the blood is red.
Yeah, yeah.
It's your buddies, you know.
Absolutely.
And later on, I had bosses who were African American. I was a captain in Fort Hood,
mm-hmm.
and my boss was a colonel. a lieutenant colonel. Eventually, he made general. James Clue, James R. Clue, and then other guys there.
And I guess another a similar question. What was your interaction with women who were in the service, nurses, stuff like that? Did you see a lot of women? Was that a
yeah? They had donut dollies there.
Would you mind explaining what that is for?
Donut dolly was a Red Cross girl, and they'd come and be nice to us. Some people thought they were prostitutes, but they would sell themselves because the guys are very eager.
But that wasn't true, was it?
I don't know if it was true or not, but it was widely thought. Because you had all these horny 19 and 20-year-olds. I was 23 when I went. I was the old guy.
Yeah.
How old are you right now?
20.
Oh, my God. You've been one of the old guys, too. They got 17 and 18-year-olds.
Oh, gosh.
Think of a guy your age over there doing that stuff.
Yeah. Huh? No. I can't imagine, honestly.
Oh, you could. Eventually, you'd imagine.
Yeah.
You'd figure it out. Oh, really? Yeah, you know, that's who did it. The young guys did it.
But all the women were nurses, right?
And, the women were nurses. They didn't have women in Army units until the mid-70s.
So that wasn't something you saw very much of?
No. The nurses, and they stayed in the compounds where they should be and protected and everything mm-hmm. else, too. You know.
And as far as, just to get an all-around picture, did you see a lot of civilians, Vietnamese civilians? Did you ever go to the major cities for leave or something?
No, not really.
What did your
I saw them along the road or little villages. I saw them there too.
So just getting out of the way of the fighting.
Yeah, they might have been VC too. So who knows?
Was that a concern? I mean, I guess that was a constant concern. Yeah. Was you didn't know who was?
Yeah, but the guys who we had hooch maids. We call them hooch maids or hooches, where you was your hut where you lived, and they polished boots and stuff like that. And we figured you had to figure that they were supplying intel into the VC.
So that. Did that worry you? Was that just a fact of life?
No, it's a fact of life.
Okay.
That's a fact of life.
So it seems like a theme when you were in Vietnam was, I don't want to say constant danger, but it was the constant realization that, you know, that this was your situation. And
that's where you were. You just were careful where you were. You had mm-hmm. situational awareness. And if something bad happened, you just hope it didn't happen to you. You say Xin Loi.
What does that mean?
Too bad in Vietnamese. You'd also say Xin Loi motherfucker. You do that one there too. But that's what they said.
I get to transcribe this.
You get to transcribe that. You can put some asterisks in there too.
I might have to.
But that's what the guys would say.
No, this is what we want. We want to hear exactly what you would say
there. They just, no, too bad about that.
Did you guys learn a lot of Vietnamese?
Actually, eventually you become, if you saw a lot of it, you get become, you know, inured to what was going on there too, if you saw too much of it. Some of the guys did, probably. I did.
What do you mean by that? Just
you're used to bad things happening.
See,
and you assume bad things were going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you said you weren't of that thought.
I do. No.
You just tried to stay positive.
Yeah. I wanted to get back.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get back.
Okay.
Can I add something about the way I was feeling?
Absolutely. When he was there? Please.
This may sound really weird, but okay, we've been married 7 months.
7 months.
So we really didn't have a life together yet. But my concern was that not so much that he would die, but that he'd come back maimed, and I'd have the rest of my life with somebody in a wheelchair.
So you had major concerns.
That was my big concern.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from wanting to beat up the people I had, the protesters I had to walk through when I went to work every day.
And
because I was in D.C. This was in D.C.
And just for the recorder, mm-hmm. what were your feelings towards those protesters?
I think I didn't understand, but I was angry.
Right.
I mean, they're young kids, mm-hmm. mostly, and I don't think they knew what they were. I don't know that they knew what they were doing, except they didn't want to go fight.
And How big was the political sphere for you guys? Was that something that you cared about, or you were just doing your duty and then, you know, going home to your wife?
Yeah, I'd say
that. The military, you're apolitical.
Okay. Would you mind explaining why that's important?
You're not supposed to be involved in politics. You're supposed to, that's a civilian's
role. So that's a rule in the military?
It's a rule.
Okay.
Well, you can't openly.
You can't openly do it.
And when you were in Vietnam, how did you and your buddies feel about the protesters back home?
They're a bunch of pieces of shit.
Would you mind explaining a little more why you felt that way?
Because we were getting being shot at over here, and those bastards over there were stabbing us in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have no use for them. I have no use for guys like Kerry. I have no use for Bill Clinton. That little weasel became president of the United States. Really, a lot of it, you know.
But when you were back in Vietnam, it was politics were aside. It was just,
yeah,
you know,
we just, we're gonna get out and do our thing and get out of here. Mm-hmm. You know?
Okay. Yeah. If there's nothing else that you wanted to add,
that's the first 2 years of first year of our marriage, I think.
Well, because I'd be happy to hear more, but for the sake of the interview, I'm supposed to stop once you return from Vietnam.
I'll tell you the rest now.
And then you can tell me about coming.
Coming home.
Well, I'll leave that on here just in case.
Coming home from Vietnam. So I come home from Vietnam. We
alone.
Huh?
Alone, basically.
Alone.
Yeah.
Get on the airplane. As soon as those wheels take off, everybody cheers in the plane.
Because you knew you were going home.
I still remember that. And then I picked something up, and we went from Saigon, and we flew up to Narita, Japan. And from Narita, Japan, we went from Japan to Hawaii, then Hawaii to San Francisco, and then from San Francisco to Dulles in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up something, I got sick.
Right.
So, now this is interesting. I had a war souvenir, which I still have it, which is an SKS rifle.
Oh, wow.
Which I brought on the airplane with me. It was in luggage. So I picked up my rifle and luggage, and I went to see, and I saw Judy, who came to see me. I gave her a big kiss, and I said, "Where's the bathroom?" I had diarrhea, straight to the bathroom. And you thought I was,
I don't know,
just sick. So, and I had about 30 days leave. So then I eventually went to the 6th Armored Cav Regiment at Fort Meade, Maryland. So as a battery commander.
So after the war, you continued, you stayed in the military.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Eventually I stayed in for 26 years, 1 month, 11 days.
That's your full service length?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So for the interview, I'm going to end it.